You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And we're in Pentecost 24, where the readings we'll be discussing today are Judges 4, 1 to 7, Psalm 123, and Matthew 25, 14 to 30. And we're delighted to be joined today by our colleague, Monica Melanchthon. Monica is Associate Professor of Old Testament here at Pilgrim Theological College in the University of Divinity. She has written far too many things to mention them all, numerous articles and chapters on particularly violence and gender, as well as issues of race and caste in the Hebrew Bible. She has a book on the theme of rejection in the Hebrew Bible, and is currently working on a feminist commentary on 1 Kings, as well as a commentary on Joshua. And it's probably also relevant to add that Monica is an ordained minister in the Lutheran tradition. So welcome, Monica.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you, Fran, for this invitation. It's great to be with a couple of women and discuss the Old Testament and yes, a little bit of the New Testament.
Yes. Just a little.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Monica. I might kick off with a question. I don't think many communities, Monica, will have heard many sermons on Judges. Can you talk a bit about why it might be important for us to preach on the book of Judges?
Yes. There are two reasons as to why the book of Judges, you know, you don't hear too many sermons on the book of Judges. First of all, Judges has a bad reputation. It's a source of embarrassment for some people, and therefore it's ignored and rejected because of the ubiquitous violence and the many types of violence that you find in the book. That is one reason. The second reason is, not surprisingly enough, the Revised Common Lectionary has only one reading from Judges, and that is Judges chapter 4, verses 1 to 7.
This one.
In the entire series.
Well, that's a good mandate to preach on Judges today, this Sunday, isn't it?
Yeah. So therefore, you know, you don't hear a lot being said about this book, particularly within the worship context. But I would like to emphasize the fact that it is part of our scriptural canon, and it has been included for reasons that may not be readily apparent. But we are invited to wrestle with it and try to understand why it has found a place within the canon. I mean, if you read Clinton McCann's commentary in the interpretation series on this particular book, he calls attention to the fact that the book raises many, many pertinent issues related to violence, politics, chaos, you know, male-female relationships, leadership, issues of leadership, and so on. In a way, the book reflects life, okay? And those are my words. But and then when you compare the situation that we are in today with the kinds of issues that were happening or the book narrates, you will see that we are really not too far off, you know. And so so the book is an invitation for us to ponder on some of these issues in theological terms. You know, despite the very earthly way in which these stories are written, you will find that there is a theological pattern within the book. The people disobey, and then Yahweh punishes the community through an enemy, and then the people cry out to God for help, and then Yahweh intervenes by raising a judge. The enemy is vanquished, and then there is 40 years of peace. And then the people unfortunately forget. In other words, human memory is really short, and we tend not to learn from the mistakes of the past. And so once again, there's disobedience, and then there's punishment, and then deliverance in the form of a judge that is raised by Yahweh. So technically, the book is calling for loyalty to God alone and faithfulness to the covenant.
Yeah, and you only have to read those first few chapters to already see that pattern you're describing of a period of judges. The judge keeps people in check, and as soon as the judge dies, everything kind of falls apart. They start worshipping Baal and other things. And, of course, we're in a period where Joshua's now died, that second great leader that followed Moses. Monica, what else do we need to know about the sort of historical context, this so-called period of the judges?
Yeah, the period of the judges lasted for about 200 years. Mm-hmm. If we go with the chronology that has been provided by scholars, it's a time in pre-monarchic Israel when the Hebrew tribes were in a very tense relationship with other peoples, namely the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Edomites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Phoenicians. And it was also a time when there was no central army or a central place of worship. There was no overarching structure of government, only a tribal form of leadership with perhaps, the circle of elders within a clan providing leadership to that particular tribe. And we don't have a lot of evidence of all the tribes of Israel coming together to fight an army, except in Judges chapter 5.
Yeah.
So therefore, it was a time when there was no overarching political structure. But reading through the book, and because of the violence within it and the very disturbing issues it raises, the book is also, that particular period is also characterized as a period of anarchy, primarily because of the way in which the book ends, the last verse in the book.
So the lectionary is giving us part of chapter 4, Monica, probably no doubt because Deborah is the only female judge in the Hebrew Bible. Are there things about this passage in particular that you would want to highlight that preachers take note of?
Yes, certainly. I would like to first of all emphasize the fact that several of the judges that are named within this book are individuals that have been drawn from the margins.
Okay.
So you have Jephthah is a good example. He was the son of a prostitute, and then you have Deborah, who is a woman. in a culture that was extremely patriarchal, the choice of these particular individuals to function as judges is quite telling for me as a reader. Of course, if you read the work of Will Gaffney, an African American biblical scholar, will say that this the choice of these leaders is to indicate that Yahweh is in charge, and it did not really matter who the leader was. Well, I'm not so sure that that is the right interpretation of the choice that Yahweh makes in choosing these elders. I'd like to think of it as an intentional choice in order to, put forth a particular message. So we have Deborah, whose name is quite interesting because the name itself is comprised of consonants that make up the word in Hebrew, which can be translated as, she spoke.
Yes, okay.
Other translators will say that the word actually means bee, like the bumblebee or the honeybee, the bee. But I think, I would go along with other feminist scholars who say that there's something powerful about translating her name as the person who spoke. If you look at verse 4 and the NRSV, she's introduced as a woman, a female, a prophet, the wife of Lapidoth, and she was judging Israel at that time. Again, the wife of Lapidoth is an issue of translation because the word Lapidoth itself doesn't necessarily mean a conjugal association, because it is derived from the word torches or fires.
Okay.
So it might be a reference to the fact that she was a fiery woman or a spirited woman. So I would question the NRSV translation, okay? But these descriptors, woman, female, prophet, fiery, a judge, are very, very unique, because you very rarely see a male prophet being introduced with all these adjectives
or
descriptors. So she was, of course, a prophet and a judge who governed and administered the tribe. You know, her responsibilities perhaps included also providing leadership or advice to the army. She solved disputes. She advocated for the powerless and made decisions. So, and she, we are told, sat under a tree, you know, called the Palm of Deborah, which is between Ramah and Bethel. And this is interesting because though she's introduced as a prophet, she's not necessarily associated with a temple or the royal. There was no royalty at that time. A temple. Mm. So, as a woman and as a lay person, represents an alternative to the structure of priesthood, you know. And she sat at a place which was apparently a high traffic area.
Okay, so like a thoroughfare or somewhere where people could easily find her.
Yeah, find her and approach her. Yeah, the text itself, presents her in a very, very positive light. She's respected for her intelligence, her connections with God. She exercised leadership with confidence, made decisions, and her advice was valued by both Barak and the people. But despite this positive treatment of a female character, interpreters traditionally have had a hard time accepting her. And so if you look at some of the more, older commentaries, you will say that, she was actually a weak vessel, but she possessed a stronger faith and her courage is termed masculine. And that God used her only because men failed to exercise leadership, you know, and that she's not supposed to be a role model, but an exception to the rule.
Yeah. But you're saying that's not in the text. That is in our history of interpretation. Yeah. The text does not present her as the exception. I was struck by the fact that her and some of the other judges too, I mean, there's a sense that she is advisor of the army. I mean, this is it's a bigger role than I think we in contemporary culture associate with a judge.
Sure.
It's far more than judicial and, you know.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, perhaps we should define judge, because it's a leader of a district, isn't it, rather than a legal term? Or
it is. The judge is functions more or less like the chief of the tribe.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's helpful.
Taking care of all businesses pertaining to the tribe. So, you know, might be the person who the spokesperson for the tribe, or, solving disputes that are both internal and between tribes, representing the tribe and giving advice where and when appropriate.
Correct. It's probably not surprising that there isn't violence in this particular selection of verses from the lectionary, but you mentioned before about having a look theologically at these events and trying to interpret the dialogue going on there. Would you be able to talk a bit about that?
Or perhaps the preaching themes?
Well, yes, and therefore how one would preach this passage.
Yeah, I think first of all, we need to acknowledge the fact that, Deborah gives this in verses, I think, is it verses 6 to 7 of the text? Deborah gives instructions to Barak.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, the text has not preserved any conversation that she has had with Yahweh. You know, in other words, you know, these are the instructions that she's received from Yahweh in a conversation with Yahweh, and then she imparts the same instructions to Barak. So it is it is interesting that we don't have a record of that, and it is possible that she speaks on her own authority. As an emissary or a spokesperson for God, she speaks on her own. She speaks on her own authority and exercises autonomy. Trusting in the fact that God, this is what God wants her to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
I think theologically speaking, therefore, one can say something about the relationship that she had with the divine, okay, that gave her this sense of agency and this autonomy. Okay, that's one idea.
Yep.
A second idea, I think, would be the fact that, you know, she is, yes, a woman in a very important position, and she gives encouragement to Barak. And some people say, you know, would like to undermine Barak, but I think what is more helpful is to speak about the partnership that existed between them, the camaraderie, the trust, and the respect between the two, and that gender was not inhibitive, for these two people to work together for the good of the community. And I think, it's also important that we as a church need to spend some time thinking about why is there this deep-seated ambivalence to women's leadership, you know. oftentimes, when women enter into positions of leadership, people try to find ways to explain how she got into that position. Rather than just celebrating her for the gifts that she brings to that office. I mean, at least that is often the case in India. It may not be the same in Australia.
I think that is the case worldwide, although I suspect that the listeners of this podcast, given that we are female-led most of the time, is fairly sympathetic to that message. Thank you, Monica. I'm learning so much listening to you talk about judges, but I think we need to move on to the psalm.
Mm-hmm.
Psalm 123 in some ways is a plea for mercy, but we get this word eyes, what, like four times in the first few verses? Is this significant?
First of all, I'd like to say that this psalm is also unique, like the judges reading.
Okay.
Because it's the only psalm that is credited to Moses. Now, of course, we know that superscriptions cannot be taken very seriously. But the superscription says, you know, a psalm of Moses, and it's the only psalm that has his name in the superscription. I think the psalm is a song of ascent, part of a group that begins at Psalm 120 and goes on to 134. It's a prayer and with a very, very simple structure. The speaking voice is that of an individual or perhaps someone who represents the community. Despite the fact that it is, the argument or the flow within the psalm is very, is deceptively simple. It begins with, we raise our eyes to God for mercy. And then it says, we are up to our necks in insult. hence, we need your help, O Lord, and yes, the power of eyes capture our attention in this psalm. I think we all know the significance of eyes and the role that eyes play when you are in a conversation or where you are in the middle of a negotiation. Eyes speak volumes, and we talk about the eyes being the mirror to one's soul. And I think if, in the first few months of when you are falling in love, the importance that eyes play in that interaction or in that communication is very important. Mm. So within this psalm, it's important for us to acknowledge the power of eyes that capture our attention in the psalm. Because the word occurs in each of the poetic lines, and in the final clause it says, have mercy upon us. I'd like to when I was reflecting on the psalm, I was thinking about the pilgrimage traditions in India, particularly because this is a song of pilgrimage. And those of us who are familiar with Hindu life will be aware of the fact that Hindus like to see their deities. And so, you know, going to the temple almost every day is a part of the ritual. And wishing to see the deity, okay, wishing to see the deity or a representative of the deity is a fundamental part of what the worship of a deity is.
Yep. And we see that in the Hebrew Bible too, of course, this constant longing, desire to see God or to make an image of God to kind of, yeah.
Yeah. And as I was reading the psalm, I was thinking of Hagar in Genesis who also names God as El Roy, the God who sees. I would like to call attention to the fact that, you know, we have a God who sees, and there is the individual who is worshiping God also wanting to see God, and therefore the pilgrimage to the temple. And so there through this visual interaction between the divine and the worshiper, there is a special sort of intimacy that evolves between them, and it confers, you know, there are benefits to both sides. And I think seeing the deity enables the worshiper to absorb some of what the deity represents, you know.
Yes.
And use that power for the transformation of the worshiper. So there is definitely a soteriological element to this desire of the worshiper wanting to see God. Go ahead. Yeah.
It does occur to me that in these parts of the world where we have to wear masks at the moment, that the eye imagery is incredibly powerful, that we are learning to read a lot more of what's going on just through people's eyes.
Yeah, we're used to seeing whole faces, and we've had to adapt. Monica, if one was to preach on the Psalms, I suspect most of us don't preach on a psalm very often, and we don't talk about the Psalms very often in this podcast, and it's something on my mind that we need to do more of. But what might you preach? You've mentioned a few themes around intimacy and the desire to see and know God. Is there anything else you'd say about how we preach this psalm?
I think it is, yes. The psalm is first of all focusing on the desire of the worshipper to be in the presence of God. Okay, what is that? What does that mean? Wanting to be in the presence of God. Why do we want to be in a place of worship when we believe that God is everywhere? And the person who goes to the temple on a pilgrimage to see God is hoping to receive something from this divine being. Okay, So one by going on this pilgrimage, the individual is changed. One, the individual perceives himself or herself as changed and transformed after having been in the presence of God. And of course, one cannot negate the fact that the psalmist uses three different metaphors, you know, as the eyes of servants, as the eyes of a maid, as eyes who look up to the Lord. So there is a progression in the psalm in terms of how the worshiper understands his or her relationship with the divine and the dependence on the divine. Okay.
Yeah. Wonderful.
I think we need to probably move on to the gospel reading at this point.
Matthew 25, 14 to 30.
That's been misunderstood a lot over the tradition to perhaps justify prosperity gospel understandings of God.
Yes, so how should we not interpret it, Fran?
Well, I think not as a moral tale about how we can make money and then make more money and then make more money, and that's what God wants. So I think it's about having a much more nuanced understanding of a talent.
Yeah, and that the talent here is a symbol for
a vast gift. So yep. I understand that it's a vast amount of money in the millions of dollars in our terms, monetarily yes. translated, but that it's actually, well, I have heard one reading suggest it's the gifts of the Holy Spirit. So this passage is about the coming time between Jesus' presence and apparent absence.
Yeah, we're talking about a delay of the master.
So what's been bequeathed is all that you need, according to your need, for this time when the master is away.
See, I don't think it's about need at all.
Well, it says here, well, not need, but it says gifts are given according to need.
Ability.
A bit yeah. like Paul's gift, saying everybody's got.
Because, I mean, I think if we were to modernise this, I'd want to say it's a parable like something like, you know, the boss of a small business says to their three workers, I'm going away, taking some leave, don't know when I'll be back. It's a bit of a mystery. I'm giving you $10 million, I'm giving you $5 million, I'm giving you $1 million, like some ridiculous amount of money for the kind of work they would normally do. You know, each according to the ability you've shown so far, go do something with it.
Mm.
The vast sums of money, I wonder if a helpful way to think about this is what's been offered them is a chance, is an opportunity or a vocation, a chance to serve the master, which takes us well out of money and also away from minimal talents. Like also please don't preach this as like, even if you've only got one little talent and you can just play the clarinet for Jesus. This is not about playing the clarinet for Jesus and using your one talent. It's about, even if it's the 1 million, you've been given still this enormously generous opportunity. And the point is step up, don't go hide your head in the sand kind of thing.
And continue the master's work.
Yes.
Which the first two do.
Yes, and actually abundantly.
And so the story seems to me the third one doesn't trust. It's sort of it's a very shallow kind of belief that we're often engaged in ourselves, where we don't fully trust that the abundance will come back or that is the master is as faithful as the master has proven the master to be, actually.
Yes.
And so we bury it away and then make up a story like, oh, but you were, you know, you don't reap where you sow and, you know, basically third one makes up a story to justify what he's done.
Well, he blames the master that because you're like this, I was too scared to do anything.
Which is a preposterous account of how Jesus has conducted his ministry.
Yep.
And so he's understandably furious.
Yes. And for me, I mean, thinking of the contemporary world, I'm conscious in the church we talk a lot these days about safe spaces. And on the one level, I understand that we need our churches to be, we have history of terrible abuse of those most vulnerable. So safe in that sense is obviously excellent. We need to be transparent. We need to be doing everything we can to, you know, get rid of abuse and violence and all of that stuff. But faith is not safe.
No, I agree.
So this parable is about being risky for the kingdom.
Mm.
Like take a risk. Yes, it's dangerous. But actually the judgment here, which is really harsh, is for the one who didn't take the risk, not the one who took a risk and failed, because we don't actually have that in the parable. It's for the one who didn't even bother risk, who saw an opportunity to, whether it's to preach the gospel, to, change some injustice in the world, you know, whatever that opportunity is, they were given a chance, a kind of a calling, and they went, not too risky.
I think that's I just react against what of moral readings of these things. Go and be a better and better Christian you can be, because that's not good news, and it's quite a boring message actually. to do as well as you can. We've got lots of people who can tell us to do as well as we can. So I'd want to go.
It's not about self improvement.
No,
I think.
If I may say you can link this reading with the Deborah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and she could have by virtue of being a woman, you know, allowed the culture to suppress her and, you know, remain within her, you know, very traditional role as a wife and so on. And yet, she realized that she had certain gifts.
Yep.
You know, and that God was calling her to perform a task, and she risked, her life to do and to achieve what she did.
I really like that linking because it's. I mean, we don't get this in the text, but we can imagine that for Deborah, that calling came with enormous cost. And yes. and any calling or vocation, stepping into the arena is the language someone like Brené Brown uses. You know, when you step up for the gospel, you step up for justice, you're going to get criticism, you're going to get conflict. But to me, the gist of this parable is the option is not to not step up. That was a really awkward sentence.
And to not to make up a false story about this God.
But, about I mean, why not?
What is this saying about God? What is this passage saying about God is the question always to ask. And I think it's in that exchange between Jesus and that third slave that you could really focus your sermon on.
Well, thank you so much, Fran and Monica Melanchthon.
Yeah, thank you, Monica.
For being with us. We've learned so much talking with you today about these Hebrew Bible passages.
And we'll definitely have you back if you're willing to come at some other point.
Oh, would love the opportunity. Thank you.
You've been listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast brought to you by the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Thanks for listening.